Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. Our guest today is Peter Sheath, a mental health nurse, a counsellor, consultant, trainer and person in long-term recovery, who has been involved in the field of health and social care for many years. He has worked in a variety of mental health settings, including managing acute psychiatric units, community psychiatric nursing, day centre management and nurse teaching. Peter is extremely passionate about addiction and its relationship with mental health. As a result, he has worked extensively in the third sector since moving into substance misuse. In 2011, Peter was invited to address the United Nations Drug Symposium and UK Drugs Consortium to talk specifically about recovery from addiction, and this will be the topic of our discussion today. Hello, Peter. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hiya, Barry. Good evening.
Okay, well, Peter, could you begin by telling us something of your background and, you know, and how you got involved in this field of work?
Yeah, I come from a council estate in my hometown, Warrington. I grew up really, really poor, to be honest. My natural father died when I was about two. My mother was had to bring up three children basically on her own. We had nothing, but I always had a sort of a good work ethic and a sense of social justice. Yeah. And when I was about 18, I applied at the local psychiatric hospital to become a mental health nurse. I'd done various jobs up until then. But, you know, I was also nursing a substance misuse problem that at the time I wasn't that aware of. But looking back, it was there.
Yeah.
From a very early age.
Uh-huh.
And I suppose in many ways, being a mental health nurse was, it gave me so many things, you know. It introduced me to human behaviour. It introduced me to psychology. It introduced me to psychiatry. And it introduced me to a whole lot of really odd people, you know, and I really wanted to understand these people. I really wanted to try and see the world through their eyes and what must it be like living with the mind that, you know, they've got, and why was it so, and how did they end up in that position? And I was really fortunate that I had lots and lots of opportunities to do them kinds of things.
Yeah.
And, you know, that basically is that it's been like an ongoing process that as I've grown in my life, I found myself more and more fascinated with the human condition.
Okay. And particularly in relation to addiction, what drew you to that? What interested you in that?
I've always been a real morbid fascination with addiction, drugs, substances. Like I was saying, I've always kind of, well, I had always been addicted to one thing or another. And looking back, even from an early age, all the music that I liked, all the books that I read, in one way or another, it was always people that was either alcoholics, drug addicts, or there was odd people with mental health problems.
Yeah.
You know, kind of normal people don't hold much of a fascination to me. You know, I like people who are odd and live on the margins of society. So, and it's strange because I didn't think that at the time. You know, it wasn't somebody that, you know, I thought I'll go and pick that book up because he's an addict, or I'll go and listen to that piece of music because she's an alcoholic. It was just kind of, that's how it was. And there's something about the way how people who have been, you know, to the depths of the books that I read, to the depths of depravity and living on the margins of society, and there's something about that inner struggle that comes out through poems, poetry, music, and art that, yeah, you know, I kind of really relate to.
Well, what is your understanding of addiction? What does it mean to you?
Now, that's another thing that has evolved and changed. And, you know, I started off myself very much in 12-step world. I stopped using 15 years ago and found the 12 steps program of Narcotics Anonymous in particular. And I very much believed that, you know, it was a disease, you know, and it, somehow I'd ended up with it. I had to then subscribe to a higher power that was the only way of getting any kind of reprieve from it. And I had to work these steps. Now, although I still believe a lot at that, you know, the idea of it being a disease has really lost its validity. You know, once I've read things about neurology and I've read things about, you know, the human condition and read different material, I think it is essentially part of being human. You know, I think everybody is addicted to something in one way or another. Now, at its most basic, we're all addicted to breathing. You know, it's an essential thing that we've all got to do that we can't stop doing.
So are you saying then the brain in addiction is simply doing what it's evolved to do rather than it's becoming diseased?
Exactly. And the person that's really, I suppose, enlightened me on that is Mark Lewis. You know, I started reading Mark's books a few years ago, and it just made so much sense to me, because by this time, the idea that addiction is a disease was rapidly losing, you know, there was too many things that was coming in, too much evidence that was being presented to me, that I could not subscribe to that any longer. And when I read Mark's first book, Memoirs of an Addicted Brain, it just made so much sense to me that, you know, that addiction is just part of being human. It's what your brain has naturally evolved to do, you know, and it's part of a learning process. Albeit, you know, it can appear quite pathological, you know, and it can really destroy people.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that essentially, you know, you move towards things that make you feel okay. You know, you move towards things that make you feel warm. You move towards things that feel okay to you, that, you know, feel comfortable. And I think addiction is just part of, as a human being, doing that.
But in that earlier stage, when you were involved with NA, was at that time the idea that your addiction was a disease in some way comforting, because it was like, it's not my fault?
Very much so. And I've talked to Mark about this, because I think that early on, some of the things that I did, you know, to get drugs, and I'm still not, you know, not proud of it in any way, shape or form. It's diabolic and awful. And I think just being able to say it wasn't me, it was me disease, kind of put a little bit of distance between me and the person that did that. Now, as time's gone on, I no longer think like that, and I fully accepted that it wasn't me, and, you know, I accept every bit of responsibility for that. But I think at the time, because it was so painful and it hurt me a lot, I think it really helped me to just say, well, it wasn't me, it was my disease.
But would you not ascribe to the idea, what I sort of take from Marx, it almost seems to be saying, it's not your fault, but it is your responsibility.
Exactly.
Rather than the more extreme forms of the choice model, addicts are just selfish and lazy, and all they need to do is make a choice. But choice is not that easy, is it?
No. And I think that, pardon the French, I think that's a load of bollocks. Now, I've worked with women who have basically overrode probably the strongest instinct that a human being's got, and that is to mother and to protect a child. And I've worked with mothers who have delivered a baby and an hour later walked out of a maternity unit to go and score. Now, you know, if that's not a powerful thing, and if choice was involved in that, You know, I just don't know where you could justify that and say she's making a choice. You know, it's beyond choice. Because a woman, you know, the most powerful thing a woman can ever happen to a woman is having a baby, and, you know, that overriding need to protect that baby. It's instinctual. It's part of the makeup. But to actually override that and walk out of a hospital, my God, that's powerful.
So, well, then how do you set up the conditions so people can start assuming responsibility?
I think responsibility is the key.
Yeah.
I think it's very difficult for addiction to coexist with responsibility. I think it's little tiny things that you start almost creating the conditions where people can give themselves permission to take responsibility. I think there's a load of pro-social role modelling that comes with it, that if I'm working with you and I am a responsible person and you can see that in me, I think that there's something comes out of that along the lines of I can give you some kind of hope.
Are you saying that the involvement with other people, role models, or not just role models, potentially family and your community is important too?
I'd say it's more than important. I think it's essential. I think when you're in that world of dislocation, disenfranchisement, marginalisation, you don't really see people that are role models. You know, what you see is drug dealers, you see other people like you, but you don't see people who are going to work every day or taking responsibility for paying the taxes and maintaining the car. And you become conditioned that that's all you deserve and that's your world. And I think to help people to start believing that there's something better out there, I think that, you know, they need to be exposed to it. They need to actually see it. But also they need to be accepted by that world as well. And when you think about the stigma that's attached to addiction and mental illness, you know, the difficulty is society doesn't want to accept them.
So in your understanding of recovery, is that at the heart of it?
I think so. I think recovery has become a very overused word and it's lost some of its gravitas. And it's become quite passe, you know, that everything's recovery now. But I think that there is something, you know, there's something really good and something essential about people moving on and people trying to get out of a situation and a world that maybe they don't feel they belong in. But I think that because it's got tied up with the usual health service kind of way of looking at things, you know, targets and you must do this and you need an expert to help you to do that, I think in many ways, it's kind of lost its purpose. It's become a commodity. It's become part of the consumerist ideal of the present day way of looking at healthcare.
Okay, and then just going back to Mark Lewis as well, he suggests that recovery, you know, is arguably more about development or moving on from addiction rather than recovering, which it sort of has the implication that that it might be a disease or that you're going back to a previous state in some way. What he suggests is that in order to move on, then your brain needs to form different neural pathways, etc.
And I think that it's about forming a new identity as well.
Yeah.
And I know Mark talks about that as well, that you're stuck with a kind of identity that is all about the world of drugs, the getting of drugs, the using of drugs, the grafting to find your drugs. And, you know, that's not an identity that you can carry forward into the world that you're trying to get accepted by. So I think a lot of it is forming a new identity, but then creating social networks that are going to help you to grow that new identity and are going to help you to nurture it and become it. Because I think it's a real alien concept initially when you're thinking, I want to be over there, but there's just too many barriers in your way to stop you actually getting over there.
Yep.
And I think if you can start people talking about the new self that they're trying to create and trying to encourage people to start investing in that new self, because the present self is really difficult to invest in. Because, you know, basically, people don't believe that they're worth investing anything in.
And related to this, Peter, is there any sort of pattern? Can you make any generalisation why people become addicted, whether it's addicted to substances or to gambling or the internet? Is there anything that in your upbringing or that can often strongly influence that?
Yeah, personally, I think it begins with pain and ends with pain. I think that if you talk to most people who's had any kind of addiction, that there's something that has occurred to them that's caused them pain. Usually something in the childhood. You know, you very rarely meet people that have got addiction problems that, you know, have had a wonderful childhood. And I think that this, it starts with people trying to manage and control the pain of stuff that happens in your childhood.
So it ties in with that model, the soothing model, in a sense, the self, what's it called? Self-medication.
Yeah, and that's another avenue that I've explored quite a lot. There's a guy called Gabor Mate who talks about it quite a lot. What he talks about is that if you grow up in an environment where the conditions aren't there for a healthy brain development, and he says the conditions are having a constantly available, nurturing caregiver, if that's missing, what Gabor Mate says is that the circuits in your brain that produce endorphins, that produce dopamine, they don't function properly. And it's when you have external medication, i.e. heroin or alcohol, that it somehow supplants the chemical that you're not able to produce in the quantity that gives you the joy in life. And then all of a sudden you take that external chemical and your brain somehow then feels complete. It's almost like there's something missing that only feels complete when you have that external chemical. And I talk about it a lot when I'm talking about my addiction, that almost every drug I took, initially it was like having a spiritual experience. You know, it was just like there was like this hole in me life that the moment I took that drug, I felt complete. You know, I felt like everyone else. But then that drug had wear off and I'd start taking other drugs with it. I'd feel that again, but then it'd go away again. And I do think that there's something in that, you know, that the brain hasn't developed in a healthy way because there was a loving caregiver missing in your childhood. And for me, when I was 2, I had an older sister. My mum was pregnant and my dad died, and he died of leukemia at 28. So you can imagine my mother was trying to look after this guy that's dying in his, you know, his late 20s. She's pregnant with a kid. I'm the middle kid and I've got an older sister, and I just don't think she had enough love to go around. And, you know, and it's no fault of hers in any way, shape or form. But, you know, I just feel that there was something missing in my childhood that maybe made me behave in a different way.
I get that with the soothing aspect of it, but what about addictions like gambling, where it sounds like it feels like it's more like a rush rather than
because I've read quite a lot about gambling. There's a great book called Addiction by Design, and what they say about gambling, it's not the winning that the gambler gets the buzz off, it's the near miss. Now I can really identify with that, because I've had periods in my life when, you know, I've gambled loads of money away, and it was just that buzz, that sort of anticipatory buzz that you've just missed out, so you've got to have another go, so it may happen the next time. When you get a win, it's kind of an anticlimax. So I can really understand that you know, that gambling buzz. But I think, again, it goes back to the, you know, this part of your brain that isn't functioning properly.
Yeah.
Because of childhood experiences that only gets to function when you have something extreme happen to it, i.e., you know, you're gambling and you keep getting near misses.
Okay, well, just move on to now something you talked about before about the limitations in what you perceive in the health service or the medical profession in general. What kind of impact do you feel psychiatry, for example, has had on addiction treatment?
I think overall, I think psychiatry, I mean, this is going to sound bad, but I think overall psychiatry has had a bad impact on just about every aspect of healthcare. I think that it's heavily influenced by psychiatrists trying to find pharmaceutical solutions to psychosocial problems. And I see addiction very much a psychosocial issue. But there's this continued emphasis on that there's some kind of pharmaceutical solution that is going to be a kind of magic bullet. I think that for the last 100 years that psychiatry has been doing that in mental health, you know, they've been trying to tell us that the brain's got some kind of chemical imbalance, and if only we could find this chemical, major tranquilizers or psychosurgery or whatever, if only we could just find this chemical, we could put the brain back in harmony and then everything would be all right. But they've done so much damage to people in that within that model. And also, I think that they've almost totally excluded psychosocial solutions. You know, even when I was training, it was almost frowned upon to talk to people who had psychosis, you know, until they was full of medication. I don't know if you ever tried talking to someone that's full of psychiatric meds. It's almost impossible. But I think that with substance misuse being, up until fairly recently, heavily aligned with mental health and psychiatry, I think it's had a real detrimental effect on it.
Well, what would you like to change then about mental health care?
I think that there's quite a lot of things going on in the world. Something I'm really interested in is a thing called open dialogue. But I think that there's lots of therapies that don't involve medication, or that they use medication for short periods of time to help people through a real crisis. But the dynamic now is that you've got to keep taking your medication or you become ill again. Now, there's not that much evidence to support that. And if you look at places that don't use medication, i.e. third world countries like India and parts of Africa, it's unknown for people to have long-term mental health problems. You know, they have an episode. Yeah. And more often than not, they get over it. But in Western society, because we use medication so much, there is quite a strong argument that the medication turns an acute kind of psychotic episode into a chronic one.
Interesting. I've read a little bit about this open dialogue, which sounds very exciting, especially what's gone on in Finland the last few years. Could you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. It really fascinates me because it fully involves all the family, and sometimes it fully involves all the village that the person lives in. So these two family therapists, who are nurses or psychiatrists, who call a session that can involve up to 20 people, and they all sit down, and the whole approach is about engaging in a dialogue. And so they just talk through, people take on roles, people start offering support, and out of that comes a real nice and real in-depth support network that the person who's maybe suffering the psychosis engages with that support network. And there may be a decision to medicate them, but everyone who's involved in the dialogue has got to agree that that's the right course of action. If there's anybody doesn't agree, well, then they carry on with the dialogue. It's all about the dialogue, you know. I ask things about, well, what about assessment and what about risk assessment and risk management? It's not even a concept that they thought about. You know, it's just that you engage these people in a dialogue, and that becomes the assessment. It becomes the risk assessment. It becomes the care plan. You know, and nothing's written without everybody being present. You don't hold any case conferences without anybody being present. You don't talk about the client without everybody being present. They've created almost a culture that's based on open dialogue. And the results are absolutely staggering. The 85% of people in Western Lapland who have a psychotic episode are off all meds within 2 years and back in work. Now, if you said that over here in the UK, that somebody with a psychotic episode would be off all their meds in 2 years and back in work, that you'd be signed up for a section in the under the Mental Health Act. You know, and this, so I think there's something about the way how we treat people over here that maybe makes the condition worse rather than better.
So in your work, have you tried to apply some of these ideas you've been talking about? For example, earlier this year, you launched a radical real-time treatment initiative in Birmingham, you know, to be there for addicts at the very point when their desire for change is ignited. Now, and well, could you talk a little about that, being there at the point, you know, when you want to change? How important is that? And then, you know, how's that initiative been going?
The idea there was, it was kind of a combination of, I suppose, the learning about neurology, learning about asset-based community development, the learning about open dialogue, and try and put that into a system that is quite radical, but is very, very different than the traditional model. So the idea was that if you've got a drug problem, you could go to your corner shop and say the shopkeeper would be trained in what we call brief interventions. So that person would either know where help was available, or he could give you the help himself that maybe put you back on track.
Yeah.
And it's kind of how things used to be before we created experts and services for everything. You know, I can remember a time as a kid that, you know, I'd got really, really drunk, and my mother called in the next door neighbour, and he sat me down and had this chat with me. And I suppose it's me trying to move it towards that kind of ideology back a little bit, so that, you know, the community becomes responsible for its own problems. Now, at the moment, you've got to create an expert to deal with people's problems. And probably 90% of the time, you don't need the expert.
And how's that been going? Have you met a lot of resistance?
Yeah, because culturally, when you've got a culture that has been working in a certain way for a long, long time, and that all the systems prop up that culture, it's really, really difficult to change, you know, a cultural way of doing something by trying to introduce a new culture. I think it's a slowly, softly approach. I don't think you get anywhere by just going in and saying, this is the model, this is how we're going to work. I think you've just got to make small changes. People have got to see them small changes. People have got to try and embrace them small changes. And I think gradually you start noticing the bigger things starting to change. It's nowhere near what we'd anticipated it would be by now. But we didn't take into account the level of paradigm shift that was needed.
Okay.
It needed a massive paradigm shift because people was probably really scared of making a transition to working in a much more equal footing with the people that they work with. You know, a lot of workers like to have that power imbalance, you know, that I'm the expert and I'll tell you what's wrong with you and I'll do things to you.
Okay, and when it doesn't work, who tends to get the blame?
Service users all the time. Or, you know, if it's something like a drug-related death, the horrible finger of blame can end up being pointed at one of the workers, you know, because maybe they've not got a sheet signed, or, you know, they've missed out on some kind of intervention.
Yeah.
And you know, that's just a horrible culture to be in.
Sure, yeah. You're also currently working on a bid for a much smaller project in East Cheshire. with potentially a slightly different tack to it. Have there been other influences that have involved you with that? And could you also tell us something about that project?
Yeah. About 7 or 8 years ago, me and this guy I'd never met went for the same job, and it's kind of almost like fate brought us together. This guy's name is Damien Grader, and I'd never heard of him, never met him or anything. And we both went for the same job. He got it and I didn't get it. We met, and whilst we was being interviewed, you know, we sort of almost like interviewed together. And we got talking. And about a month after he got appointed, he kind of headhunted me, and because he liked what I was saying and he felt I could work with him. And within a month, I was like working as his kind of deputy. And it's just this whole demeanour. You meet certain people in your life that are teachers, you know, just naturally they've got something about them, some kind of charisma, some inner peace, that the stuff that they tell you and the way that they are, it's almost like a continual life lesson. Now, I say this about him, and I've said it to his face, and you know, when we sat down, we've talked about it. And he says the same about me. So, you know, it's kind of a mutual teaching thing. Now, Damien left the organisation that we were both working for around about 4 years ago and wanted to set up his own community interest company. And he calls it the Midpoint Allegiance. And it's kind of not service. It's not the recovery community, but it's that interspace between the two. You know, it kind of works outside the services, but it interlinks people with the recovery community, but without all the nonsense like governance and all the regulations that come with it. So it's a very free movement and a free flow. And for the past 2 years, I left the company 2 years ago. For the past 2 years, I've been working with him. On this Midpoint Allegiance thing, so developing stuff that is moving the way our treatment works into a more community focused thing, but also really, really focusing on developing recovery communities. And a couple of weeks ago, we got onto this bid in East Cheshire where they're looking for an organisation to come in and provide housing for really, really chaotic people who nothing's worked for. So these are street homeless people, people with severe mental illness, chronic street drinkers. And what the project is to try and engage them people, try to give them some kind of respite and some kind of shelter, and hopefully within that some kind of stability. And it's really interesting me because I think that the people that they're expecting us to work with, if we're successful, don't get a very good deal. You know, they don't get a good deal from treatment, they don't get a very good deal from mental health services, they don't get a very good deal from A&E or the GPs. And I'm hoping that we can maybe start influencing the offer that they get from all them services by being placed to advocate for them, to create something beautiful in the ugly world that maybe they live in. Yeah. Some kind of little oasis where they can go every night, they can feel safe, they can feel comfortable. Now, if within that they decide to move towards recovery, that's fine. But also, I think we've got to respect that, you know, we want to try and meet them where they are without wanting to change them in any way as well. So it's just about like, let's just meet them, let's engage with them and let's see where it goes, and not, you know, not try and force them into any particular modality or any way of being. It's just like the whole thing is about let's just sit with you.
Connection.
You know, it's just really excited me. And you know, you walk through the streets of Birmingham, you just see loads of people on the streets in sleeping bags and talking to themselves and drinking themselves to death, you know, and they're sleeping out on these winters nights, and you just think, maybe this little project can turn into something really big, because it could become a model for other areas.
Oh, well, that sounds really inspiring, Peter. Well, and, you know, I wish you the best of luck with that. What are your thoughts on decriminalisation or the legalisation of drugs?
Personally, this is my own personal opinion, I think that the war on drugs is completely unsustainable. I think that it's probably created the situation that we're in now. I think that prohibition just doesn't work. People will always get drugs. People will always use drugs. And I think some kind of decriminalisation and some kind of taxation and some kind of way of making them freely available, I think is the only way to go. Anybody who's looked at it and looked at it objectively, I think you can't help but come up with that.
And there's the example of Portugal, isn't there, where for about 15 years now, they've basically legalised drugs. And again, the results are very, very positive, aren't they?
Astonishing. I mean, you've got Portugal. There's a few others as well. There's a few Latin American countries that have done the same and exactly the same results. I think the evidence is there. You know, it's just, it's the illegality. You've only got to look at legal highs, you know, legal highs, that's a misnomer, but you know, you've only got to look at them and look at the whole bloody chaos that's come with them. That you just realise that if you could regulate them and if you could sort of make them available and people would know what they're buying and you could give proper information and you'd know what was in the packet, people wouldn't be dying every weekend.
I suppose even for people that are inclined towards this, though, that, you know, parents would be concerned when they're children become 17 or 18 and potentially just being able to go and buy some heroin or cocaine from the corner shop, though.
That's not what I'm advocating for. I think that there's got to be some kind of regulation about it. You know, they can go and buy cigarettes, can't they? That's probably more harmful than heroin is. But yeah, the way how the government has legislated against it, heroin comes out as the worst drug known to man. I would argue that and say probably nicotine and cigarettes are the worst drug known to man.
Yeah.
Alcohol comes a close second.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, because they're legal and because the government makes so much money out of them, they wouldn't even think of making them illegal.
No, that makes sense, Peter. Okay. What's your understanding of the middle way and how might that relate to what we've been talking about today?
My understanding from talking to you and reading your website and looking at different, you know, applications of the middle way is I think that's exactly what we've been talking about all the way through. You know, when you asked me about the legality of drugs.
Yeah.
What I was trying to advocate there is that, you know, you're not just walking in a corner shop and being able to buy it, but some kind of middle way that, you know, it's sort of, it's not completely illegal, but it's maybe more available. And I think that there's lots of situations where we get bound up in the dogma and we start making decisions based on the dogma. And a lot of the time it's because we've always done it a certain way, or, you know, it's part of our cultural heritage. And I think that rather than just going completely in the opposite direction, there's often something that's right in the middle. I did do this workshop on being stuck, and I always show this film. It's a bloke called Yuri Allon, who's a lecturer in mathematics. And he talks about we get bound up in thinking that solutions are always an A to B route, kind of linear journey, that A is the problem, B is the solution, and all we've got to do is get from A to B. And he says that happens a lot in academia, that, you know, people kind of delude themselves that it's as easy as that, and they keep battering away at it and they keep getting stuck. And he says, but there is another way of looking at this, and it's that, you start off with A's the problem, B might be the solution, but it's only by engaging on that journey and maybe getting stuck, he calls it being in the cloud, that a C might appear. And the solution may be C, but you're not seeing it because you're almost obsessed in getting from A to B. And I think that's the middle way as well.
No, I definitely agree with that, yeah. That's brilliant, Peter. And how hopeful are you for the future with regard to attitudes to addiction and recovery?
I'm very hopeful. I think that there's lots of people around that are getting themselves in more and more influential positions that kind of think like me. And I know they are because I talk to them all the time and we meet and we sort of share our successes and we share our frustration. And we're getting to be more and more influential, you know, more and more conferences are asking us to speak at the conferences. We're getting quite a wide audience. You know, I must train thousands of people every year.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, it's like that stuff that them small things coming together make a big difference. And I do think that, you know, what I'm seeing is a shift. I'm seeing people are developing a different attitude. Like I say all along, you know, it's a really slow process because you're dealing with really, really entrenched behaviours and entrenched customs.
Yeah. So you have to be in for the long haul then, yeah?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, I was 60 this year, and it's whether I've got enough steam for the next few years. I'm hoping so. I'm hoping so, but you never know.
Okay. And then my last question. If people wanted to find out more about your work, how would they go about it?
Right. I blog quite a lot on Mark's website, so that's Mark Lewis at memoirsofanaddictedbrain.com, I think it is.
Yeah.
And the other site that I blog on is Emerging Horizons website. Friend me on Facebook, just put Peter Sheath. I'm pretty certain there's not that many other Peter Sheaths. And I write quite a lot on Facebook. Or email me.
Well, it's been really great to talk to you, Peter, really fascinating, and yeah, I'm sure a lot of the listeners will have got a lot out of what you said today.
Thank you, Barry. I've been really good being interviewed by you. So it's really good.
You can find out more about Middleway Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.